Good evening, friends. This is a reading of The Messenger on July 21st. This is from the double issue, printed on July 19th. Parishioners, Year of Mercy inspired pastor to push for clarification in cremated remains law. This is from Laura Keener, the editor. The Jubilee Year of Mercy, from December 8th, 2015 to November 20th, 2016, is still having an impact in the Diocese of Covington, and now the state of Kentucky. In the last General Assembly, HB 110 passed unanimously, and rather, anonymously. There were no public debates or protests, but its impact is not insignificant. Governor Matt Bevin signed the bill on March 29th. Representative Joseph Fisher was the primary sponsor of the bill, but if you ask him, he might refer to it as Father Steph's bill. The bill, which is now law, permits funeral directors who are in possession of unclaimed cremated remains for 2 years or more to enter, bury, entomb, or place the cremated remains in a columbarium, or to deliver the cremated remains to a bona fide religious society, veterans organization, or civil group for interment, burial, entombment, or placement in a columbarium. Before the bill, funeral directors could be held liable if at some time, even an eternity from now, a family member came to claim the cremains and the cremains were not available. And so, the unclaimed cremains of people, probably hundreds, maybe even 1,000 or more, have languished on the basement shelves of the more than 400 funeral homes throughout the state of Kentucky. Father Steph Bancamper, pastor, St. Catherine of Siena Parish in Fort Thomas, learned of this legal flaw when speaking with a parishioner who was a local funeral director. It was during the Jubilee Year of Mercy, and as he prayed and reflected on Christ's mercy and what that means to the church, the plight of these forgotten people became more and more dear to Father Bancamper. It occurred to me that this is not equal to the dignity of a human person to be sitting in a basement unburied for the rest of eternity until Jesus comes back, said Father Bancamper. And the second thing that occurred to me was that it's the Year of Mercy, and burying the dead is a corporal work of mercy. Father Bancamper approached Representative Fisher, a parishioner, about the situation, and together they worked on writing the bill. Quote, "One thing I insisted on in the bill was for interment, burial, or placement in a columbarium, something appropriate for the Catholic Church," Father Bancamper said. Quote, "You can't just spread them around, and so that's in the bill." It took a year for the bill to make it into committee. The first year, they simply ran out of time. Representative Fisher and State Senator John Schnickel, who also helped draft the legislation, wanted to be sure that the bill would have the support of Kentucky's funeral directors. The funeral directors not only supported the bill, but helped lobby for it as well. It does become a problem. Funeral homes all over the state have cremated remains, said Sidney Fogle, executive director of the Funeral Directors Association of Kentucky. Mr. Fogle said that he worked with Representative Fisher and Father Bancamper to help pass the legislation. Before the legislation, Mr. Fogle said funeral directors, quote, could do some of those things, but it wasn't written in statute. Before the legislation, a funeral director would be very reluctant to turn over these cremated remains to a third party. A family member could show up years later and ask where their family member is. There was really no directive on it. As is so often the case in situations like this, when there is no directive, nothing happens, said Senator Schnickel. About the bill's unanimous bipartisan support, Senator Schnickel said, quote, it's common sense. Representative Fisher concurred, quote, people felt like this was an oversight in the law that would benefit those who would otherwise be forgotten, he said. Additionally, Representative Fisher said that the funeral directors would develop an internal tracking system, so they'll have a record of whom the cremains have been delivered to. That record would be kept for at least 10 years. Mr. Fogle does not know the exact number of unclaimed cremated remains in Kentucky. I could not guess. I would dare say there is not a funeral home in the state that doesn't have at least one set sitting around, he said. He also said there isn't a very clear reason why. Despite the funeral director's attempts to have the cremated remains claimed, family members refuse to pick them up. Some might not have next of kin. Some of it is money, I think, or the family doesn't know what to do. I think a lot of times family members think that once the cremation occurs, that's it. There's nothing left. Or they don't have any more responsibility, he said. Mr. Fogle said that Father Bancamper is not the only one interested in making sure that these forgotten people receive a proper and dignified burial. There are veterans groups who search for unclaimed cremated remains of veterans, and they will bury those remains or entomb them with full military honors, he said. In Kentucky, Dale LeMond is one of those people. He is the Central U.S. Regional Coordinator for the Missing in America Project, otherwise known as MIAP. The Missing in America Project is a federally recognized nonprofit veterans organization. Its mission is a nationwide effort to locate, identify, and inter the unclaimed remains of forgotten veterans. According to the organization's website, which you can reach at www.miap.us/index/ASP, MIAP has visited 2,346 funeral homes across the United States and have found 19,661 cremains, have identified 4,349 cremains as those of veterans, and have interred 4,008 veteran cremains. Mr. LeMond, who is also supportive of HB 10, he agrees that some people have the wrong idea about cremation. He remembers speaking to the daughter of one of the veterans MIAP interred. She asked me, "How can you have my father's cremains when my mother said he was cremated and there's nothing left? People get the wrong idea that with cremation, there is nothing left," he said. Mr. Fogle expressed his gratitude to Father Bandkemper and Representative Fisher for drafting the bill and working on its ratification. Quote, "I commend the Catholic Church in Northern Kentucky for getting involved, and also Representative Joe Fisher, who introduced the bill. We have worked with him over the years. It was very good foresight for those organizations, and we were happy to help them get this done," he said. Father Bandkemper is now working with the diocesan councils on developing protocols for acquiring and interring unclaimed cremains. Moving over here, an article. On the Feast of Our Lady of Mount Carmel, Bishop Foyes thanks Carmelite sisters for ministry. This is from Laura Keener, the editor. On the Feast of Our Lady of Mount Carmel on July 12th, Bishop Roger Foyes celebrated Mass at Carmel Manor in Fort Thomas. Our Lady of Mount Carmel is the patroness of the Carmelite Sisters for the Aged and Infirm, who sponsor and operate Carmel Manor. Carmel Manor is one of 17 facilities, 16 in the United States and one in Ireland, operated by the Carmelite Sisters, offering independent, assisted, and nursing care to the elderly. In his homily, Bishop Foyes spoke of the importance of God choosing Jesus to be born of a woman, and how it ties with John's Gospel passage, from chapter 19, verses 25 through 27, with Jesus giving Mary to John as his mother and mother of us all. Quote, "God chose to send his son to be born of a woman, to allow Jesus to have the love of a mother," he said. "Everyone knows the love of a mother, the care that a mother has for her children. That is a love unlike any other in our lives. Jesus giving us his mother, Mary, as a mother, trusts us to her care. We can go to her with any of our needs, knowing that as a mother, especially as the mother of God, she will hear us and intercede for us. What mother would not intercede for her children? What mother does not want what is best for her children? So God gives us the Blessed Virgin Mary as our mother to care for us in our journey." In closing, he thanked the Carmelite sisters for answering the Lord's call in their life and for their ministry to the aged and infirm, especially at Carmel Manor, and asked those present to pray for vocations to the Carmelite order. At a private ceremony at St. Teresa's Mother House in New York on July 6th, the community welcomed three postulants. Sister Doris, Sister Sharon, and Sister Morgan each received the Carmelite habit and a religious name. "On this day, when we celebrate Our Lady of Mount Carmel, we especially give thanks for the Carmelite sisters who have, for so many years, labored here, a labor of love and care for others," he said. "We thank all the sisters who have given their life up in service to the Lord and in service to God's people." Following Mass, Bishop Foyes, Father Joseph Shelton, administrative assistant to the bishop, the Carmelite sisters, residents, and guests continue the celebration in the parlor with pastries and refreshments. Another article here in the commentary section. Evangelical realism, not a pharisaical exclusion. This comes from commentary from Father Ronald Kettler. In his opening address at the Congress on the Family for the Diocese of Rome in 2016, Pope Francis set forth a spirituality to inspire the reflection and dialogue of the Congress participants. His message centered on several biblical images as touch points for pastoral discernment in the light of Amoris Laetitia, The Joy of Love, from 2016. The post-synodal apostolic extortion on the gospel of marriage and the family. The second scriptural image evoked by the Holy Father was that of the Pharisee, taken from the parable of the Pharisee and the tax collector, in Luke chapter 18, verses 9 through 14. From that passage, "I give you thanks, O God, that I am not like the rest of men," from Luke 18, verse 11. Referring back to Amoris Laetitia, the Pope unmasks the temptation of the Pharisaical separatist logic. Regarding the inclination towards so-called Pharisaical exclusion, the Holy Father states, "We think we gain an identity and security every time we differentiate ourselves and isolate ourselves from others, especially from those living in a different situation. In reality, disciples of Jesus are summoned to continual and ongoing conversation, a disposition that grounds, quote, an attitude of humility and listening." With a clear reference to the New Testament parable of the wheat and the weeds from Matthew chapter 13, verses 24 through 30, and in 36 through 43, Pope Francis illustrates both God's realism and evangelical realism. He observes, quote, "This does not mean not to be clear in doctrine, but to avoid falling into judgments and attitudes that do not take in the complexity of life." However, the Pope notes that the spirit of evangelical realism knows the weeds and wheat grow together, and the best wheat in this life will always be mixed with a bit of weeds. Pope Francis concludes, "The Church's pastors, in proposing to the faithful and the full ideal of the gospel in the Church's teaching, must also help them to treat with compassion, avoiding aggravation or unduly harsh or hasty judgments. The gospel itself tells us not to judge or to condemn, both in Matthew chapter 7, verse 1, and in Luke chapter 6, verse 37. Earlier in his Angelus address on July 30th, 2014, Pope Francis also applied insights drawn from the parable of the wheat and the weeds. "The patient writing of the householder to not uproot the weeds stands in bold relief against the backdrop of his servant's impatience to destroy." The Holy Father commented, "We are sometimes in a hurry to judge, classify, place the good here and the bad beyond, but God knows to wait. He looks to the field of every person's life with patience and mercy. He sees better than us in the dirt and evil, but he also sees the seeds of good and looks forward with confidence for them to mature." Again, in this Angelus address, Pope Francis clarified the understanding of evangelical patience. Evangelical patience is not indifference to evil. One cannot make confusion between good and evil. In the face of the weeds of the world, the disciple is called to imitate the patience of God, nurturing hope with the support of an unshakable faith in the ultimate victory of the good, that is, of God. The discourse on parables is narrated in chapter 13 of the Gospel according to Matthew. These stories of God form the third of the five major discourses that structure the framework of Matthew, the Gospel of the Church, found in Matthew chapter 13, verses 1 through 53. Chapter 13 opens with the well-known parable of the sower and the seeds, which explores the various disposition in response to Jesus' proclamation of the kingdom of heaven, Matthew chapter 13, 1 through 9. An allegorical explanation of the parable of the sower is inserted in Matthew chapter 13, verses 16 through 23. The parable of the weeds among the wheat, found in Matthew chapter 13, verses 24 through 30, follows the allegorical explanation of the parable of the sower, Matthew 13, verses 16 through 23. It's unique to Matthew. An allegorical interpretation of the parable of the weeds is given in Matthew 13, verses 36 through 43. An additional brief parable, the parable of the fishnet, can also be found in Matthew 13, verses 47 through 50, and it dovetails with the theme of the parable of the weeds. In Matthew's era, the post-70s of the first century, the Church was confronting discouragement and internal struggles occasioned by the lack of universal acceptance of Jesus' preaching and teaching. The point of this parable focuses on the need for disciples to exercise patience and tolerance, lest in uprooting evil, the potential for good be destroyed. In his Lifting the Burden, Reading Matthew's Gospel in the Church Today from 2004, Jesuit Father Brendan Brine notes that, like the farmer, God is patient, prepared to tolerate evil along with the good, until the time for the harvest has come. In the long run, at the harvest, the good, the kingdom, will prevail. Contrasted with the zealots' impatient uprooting, God, the Lord of the harvest, knows that good and evil in human hearts stem from the same prior disposition. Divine patience grants grace time to work its victory. In the end, the spiritual death of evil will not be crushed, but rescued and transformed for life. In his exegesis of the parable of the wheat and weeds, Father John P. Meyer first notes that the text expresses Jesus' rejection of the separatism and the rigorism of the Pharisees, the Quamernites, and the Zealots. This noted scripture scholar then distills the heart of the matter. He writes, "Up until the parousia, the church will always be a mixed bag of good and evil. It should not play God by trying to purify itself completely through purges and inquisitions." In the same vein, Jesuit Father Daniel P. Harrington, in 2014, in his The Gospel of Matthew, likewise offered a similar exegesis. The parables of in Matthew 13 address the mystery of the rejection and acceptance of Jesus' word of the kingdom. The parables shed light on a painful reality for Jewish Christians, one encountered not only during the public life of Jesus, but also in the late first century life of Matthew's church. The parables call for patience and tolerance rooted in a confident trust that the final judgment there will be a separation between the just and unjust, along with appropriate rewards and punishments. The allegorical explanation of the parable of the wheat and the weeds, Matthew 13, verses 36 through 43, affirms the appropriate response to the mixture of good and evil in the field of the world and the church. Patience and tolerance until the final judgment, when God will set matters straight. As Father Meyer explains, the mixed presence of good and evil in the world and in the church before the close of the age stands as a summons to repentance while there is still time. Hence, the allegorical interpretation of the wheat and the weeds and the parable of the dragnet, found in Matthew 13, verses 47 through 50 and 36 through 43, appear to nuance a shift of the parable's center of gravity from the need for patient tolerance now to the fearful judgment to become. In his Matthew, God with Us, Father Donald D. Withrop confirms the consensus of exegetes on the situation faced by Matthew's community. Troubled by the presence of some evildoers, those who would lead others astray, there may have been an urge to cut them out, like some cancer, and throw them away. That sort of outlook reflects the temptation to set things right immediately, a propensity to have little patience to wait for God's own time of judgment. Dominican Father Benedict Viviano's study in the New Jerusalem Biblical Commentary sums up well the point of the parable on the weeds. Quote, "The kingdom is a mixed body of saints and sinners on earth until the final sifting by God's agents. Nonetheless, although Matthew counsels patience, tolerance, and forbearance, the church needs constant reformation and positive action, including the quest for holiness, yet must avoid unrealistic purism or angelism." Pope Francis weaves the spirituality of the parable of the wheat and the weeds throughout the tapestry of Evangelii Gaudium, or The Joy of the Gospel, in 2013. His apostolic extortion of the proclamation of the gospel. From the standpoint of the parable of the weeds among the wheat, the Holy Father recognizes that an evangelical community, while being concerned with a good harvest, should not become impatient at the weeds. For in the story, the sower's noticing of the weeds sprouting up does not degenerate into grumbling or overreaction. Moreover, an expansive vision, an awareness not constricted by expecting immediate success and results, must inspirit the mission of evangelism in the long run. The parable of the weeds among the wheat, again found in Matthew 13, verses 24 through 30, graphically illustrates an important aspect of evangelical work. The enemy can intrude upon kingdom and sow harm, but ultimately be defeated by the goodness of the wheat. In chapter 5, entitled Spirit-Filled Evangelicizers, Pope Francis identifies the present reality of the resurrection of Christ, an event that invites evangelicizers to discover this and to experience this. The point of the resurrection proclaims that Christ is risen, glorified, and is the wellspring of our hope. the Holy Father synthesizes insights into the vital power of the resurrection from the parables of the kingdom in Matthew chapter 13, the parables of the mustard seed, the leaven, and the weeds among the wheat. Faith in the redemptive power of Christ's resurrection assures the hope that Christ's resurrection everywhere calls forth the seeds of the new world. Even if they are cut back, they grow again, for the resurrection is already secretly woven into the fabric of this history, for Jesus did not rise in vain. Again, this commentary was from Father Ronald Kettler, and Father Ronald Kettler is director and episcopal liaison to the Messenger, and a professor of theology at Thomas More University. Changing over now, we'll read another article here focused on the topic of grace. This is Trusting in God's Grace, and it's from Karen Coleman, the Messenger correspondent. When Sister Mary Agnes Cashman was in the second grade, a dream of becoming a teacher and a religious sister began to take root in her mind. That dream lingered, but the path towards her vocation took quite a few years and some unexpected detours. Before she arrived at St. Anne's Convent, the provincial home of the Congregation of Divine Providence in the quiet rural town of Melbourne in 1985, her life had been anything but quiet. Sister Mary Agnes grew up in Chicago, her parents' sixth child and only daughter. Through 12 years of Catholic education, she held on to her dream. Her father told her she could be anything she wanted to be, but insisted that she get a college education first. She completed 2 years of college, but found it difficult to afford the tuition. Intrigued by the notion that serving in the military could provide her with the means to fund her education through the GI Bill and an opportunity to see a bit of the world, she joined the Army in 1977. Following completion of basic training and computer school, Sister Mary was assigned a post in Yongsan, South Korea. She loved her experience there and enjoyed working with the Korean people, traveling their country, and taking courses in conversational Korean. At the end of her 3-year commitment, she decided there was a lot to see in Europe, re-enlisted for an additional 3 years, and was stationed in Karlsruhe, Germany. She had a high security clearance and could visit any of the non-communist countries. She used her leave to travel, experiencing midnight mass at the Vatican and Christmas Day in the Alps. When separated from the service, she worked as a programmer at Walter Reed Army Medical Center. Her dream of becoming a teacher was still alive, but she wondered if her idea of becoming a religious was just a childhood dream and not really a call. When she tried to deny the call, she became unhappy and disoriented. She came to realize she was ignoring God's call. Once she came to terms with that, the headaches, the unhappiness, and discontentment disappeared. She began to take a serious look at various religious communities and found the right fit when she paid a visit to St. Anne's. She began living as a postulant in the convent at St. Bernard Parish in Dayton, but delayed the novitiate for several years. She wanted to utilize the $400 per month supplement from the GI Bill she had earned from her years in the military. With a bachelor's in elementary education from Northern Kentucky University in hand, she entered the Congregation of Divine Providence in 1988. The sister received a master's of education from NKU and lives out her life's dream as a teaching religious. Sister Mary said, "So many of us struggle to know if we are really hearing a call, and little things, like giving up the keys to my car, symbolized my real separation from some things of the world. But God always gives us the graces we need as we go through life." God's graces were certainly present in the life of Sister Leslie Keener, who was searching and struggling on her own vocation journey. She grew up attending Catholic schools, but didn't experience a close relationship with God. She went to church, but her faith was not at the center of her life. When she arrived at the University of Cincinnati, she was immersed in a completely secular society where her faith wasn't around her. Her first few years at UC were difficult. She began to question her faith, searching and struggling. An evangelical Christian group wasn't a good fit, but the phrase personal relationship with God touched her. She began to pray and felt for the first time that God was with her in a very loving way. It was an important conversion moment for her. She turned to the Newman Center Parish at UC and was moved by what she found there and became involved with campus ministry. She wanted to see what would happen now that she really had God in her life.
Mentored by the pastoral staff there, she was surprised to find herself leading retreats and giving retreat talks. While still in college and doing student teaching, she became more involved, joined the women's group, and sponsored someone in RCIA. She received her bachelor's and master's degrees from UC in 1998 and began teaching at Notre Dame Academy. She made friends with some of the sisters there and felt a sort of resonance with them. Her aunts among the Benedictines and Divine Providence congregation felt she was called to religious life. One day she began asking a friend about religious life, and suddenly the idea was in her mind all the time. She was drawn to the spirituality of simplicity of the Congregation of Divine Providence, and felt there was something in the sisters that resonated with her. She was invited to take a step towards vocation, and although somewhat fearful, she also felt at home, ventured on, and entered the congregation in 2000. Sister Leslie says that God steered her to a community that is about trusting in God's care because he wanted to help her do just that. She made final vows in 2008 and is now director of vocations for the congregation. She says that God continues to call people to religious life, and she enjoys speaking with college retreatants and women in discernment. Her life is very much like everyone's, with its ups and downs, periods of happiness and fulfillment, and times of doubt and confusion. But her trust in God's provident care has grown because of the awesome spiritual women of her community. As a spiritual director, she knows that we are not meant to do spiritual life alone. Switching over now, just a little bit of time left today. I want to cover a couple of small announcements here. So, official announcements effective Monday, July 1st in 2019. Reverend Jason Bertke, two chaplain of Notre Dame Academy for the term of 1 year and continues other duties. Reverend Michael Black, to chaplain at St. Patrick High School for a term of 1 year, continues other duties. Reverend Edward Brodnick, to chaplain of Bishop Brossard High School for a term of 1 year, continues other duties. Reverend Matthew Cushing, to chaplain at St. Henry District High School for a term of 1 year, continues other duties. Reverend Michael Hennigan, chaplain of Covington Catholic High School for 1 year, continues other duties as well. Reverend Nibby Kenai, to chaplain of St. Henry's District High School term for 1 year, continues other duties. Reverend Ross Kelsch, to chaplain of Newport Central Catholic High School for a term of 1 year, continues other duties. Reverend Baiju Kittigen, to chaplain of Villa Madonna Academy for a term of 1 year, continues other duties. Reverend Thomas Robbins, to chaplain of Holy Cross District High School for a term of 1 year, continues other duties. And Reverend Robert Rodgers, to chaplain of Bishop Brosser High School, for a term of 1 year, also continues other duties. Reverend Ryan Stenger, to chaplain of Covington Latin School, for a term of 1 year, continues other duties. And Reverend Jeffrey Von Lehman, chaplain of Holy Cross District High School, for a term of 1 year, continues other duties. Effective on Monday, July 11th in 2019, Deacon Charles Melville to the Pastoral Association of St. Barbara Parish in Erlanger. A couple quick announcements here. August birthdays. On the 2nd, we have Sister Barbara Marie Herlander. On the 3rd, Sister Kathy Bauer and Sister Martha Belting. On the 4th, Sister Patricia Jean Cushing. On the 6th of August, Sister Judith McMahon. And on the 7th, Sister Rosemary Lee. The 8th of August brings us Sister Patricia Marie Tyree and Sister Krista Kenbrick. On the 9th, Sister Mary Rachel Nerone. 10th of August, birthdays for Sister Bertha Burling and Sister Eileen Bursch. On the 11th, Sister Mary Shannon Krieg and Sister Grace Ann Schursall. On the 12th, Sister Barbara Rohe. And on the 15th, Sisters Mariana Rumke, Sister Mary Ann Nixburn. On the 16th of August, Sister Mary Jean Claire Lamping. And on the 17th, Sister Judith Marie Hagen. The 18th brings Sister Margaret Stallmeyer and Sister Elizabeth Kelman. On the 25th, Sister Mary Harrietta Gospel, Sister Emmanuel Pieper, Sister Martha Walther. On the 28th, Sister Teresa Falkstein. And on the 29th of August, Sister Colleen Winston. Very happy birthday to all of those folks. And that's all the time we have for today. So this has been The Messenger. I'm Zach Ryland. And on 7/28, July 28th, we'll continue with the other part of this issue. Thank you very much.